Right. Well, welcome back to Awkward-ish. Like mental health, addiction, domestic violence, and everything in between. I am your one of your hosts, Ruby, along with my co-host, Tony.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking about early recovery. Tony, would you like to get started with that?
Yeah. It seems like sometimes in early recovery, everything is great, right? Like, everything is going good, but yet, again, like, part of you is like, when's the other shoe gonna drop? And there's, like, these anxieties that are around that. Like, why are things going so good for me? And it's, like, part of that self-destructive nature that's built or learned in addiction. And you know, sometimes things are great, but something feels off, and then I would self-sabotage in the beginning. Like, I wouldn't allow myself to enjoy whatever good thing was happening to me because I felt unworthy.
And that's pretty common. When we're in our addictive behaviors, a lot of the time we get deeper and deeper into it because we feel unworthy, because we feel like we deserve the bad things that come to us. We feel like crappy people for the things we put our families through, which creates this cycle. You know, I use because I feel bad, and then I feel bad because I use, and so I deserve to feel bad. And it just becomes this really huge downward spiral.
Yeah. It's like, when things are bad, it's easy to wallow in the mess and stay stuck in it. And then it's like, you know, you don't progress forward, or it's because it's comfortable, because it's what you've known in the past. And it's like, it's very much like a arrested development in that sense.
Oh yeah. Well, we dove in feet first today. So I know a huge part of rebuilding trust with those our friends and family and people close to us. I know a lot of times we burn bridges. We've done things that we aren't proud of and hurt our family members. And so when we begin to change and do things right, they are consciously optimistic. And it can be hurtful to see that they still don't accept it, because we know the differences and changes that we've made internally. And it kind of feels like, well, why don't they see that?
Right. But at the same time, it's like, playing devil's advocate, is like, we look at all the damage we've done. Mm-hmm. Like, how many times have we not showed up when we said we would? How many times had we lied about what we were doing and then ended up being caught? And then, oh no, nothing. I'm not doing anything. Like, gaslighting them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was like, it just comes with the territory. You know, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, that it really becomes like this thing where it's like, because I felt that, like, I'll talk about my experience, like, earlier this week, okay? Like, I have some court issues stuff going on because, you know, my addiction in the past. And, like, I'm on probation for about, informal probation for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing good. I've been doing so good. In fact, like, you know, I've had nothing but negative tests, except this last one. And it's because of my medication. And they believe me now, but it took some getting there, because I've taken like 4 tests, and it's like, the county's test is coming up positive, but the one I take at my IOP is coming up negative. So it's like, when I told my sister that, she was kind of like spooked about it and didn't, you know, necessarily believe. So, like, if you're, you know, if you're dirty, you know, just stop it now before it spirals. And she was just kind of optimistic. Not optimistic, but cautiously optimistic that I was telling her the truth. And, you know, my mom was just worried. And so were my sisters. Because they know, like, how easily it can be, you know, one of those things can throw you off. Especially in early recovery. Like, I'm already, like, what, almost 6 months in, you know. But it's still really early for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, it'll take some time to rebuild back that trust. And, you know, it's like, I still have to a lot of stuff to undo from things I've caused. Like, I still need to get my license back. I still need, and it seems like all these things are insurmountable, right? But there are things that, like, can be done. Like, I was, all I needed to do is look at my hospital records and really get a doctor's overview and the DMV form. And that's what I did. I went to the records of the hospital where I stayed was, where they initially revoked my license, and because I was in an accident, and it wasn't due to the drugs, but it was like there was a lot of mental health stuff going on at that time. Like, you know, I was having a lot of anxiety. I just went through a breakup. And you know, these are things that come with early recovery, like all these little crazy things that are just like going on, and you're like holding on for dear hope, and then it's like it feels like it's you against the world at times.
Yeah, and then at the same time, you don't really have the tools to be able to handle things in a healthy way, because hey, you have coping mechanisms, but they're not necessarily healthy coping mechanisms. It's like, in the back of your mind, you're like, okay, I know how I can make these feelings go away, but that way is what got you into all the trouble. So you're kind of find all the healthy ways to cope that you can, but at the same time, like so many of us, we've had issues. We want to be on right now.
Yeah.
You know, we want to be okay now. We want to have clean time now. We want to feel better now. You know, it can be so difficult for us to have patience.
Yeah, and which brings me to my next point. When things are neutral and boring, there I go looking for something else to fill that void. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For something else, like, I can't quite put my finger on it. It may not necessarily be drugs, but it could be something else, like something exciting, anything to fill that void. And then when things are exciting and things are good, I'm like, okay, how long is this going to last? Which brings me against that cycle that I talked about before and that you did too.
Yeah. And you know, it's so funny that you said that, because that's actually in my notes too, figuring out, what to do with your time and remembering and finding new hobbies and interests. An idle mind is the devil's playground.
Yeah.
I know that very well.
Yeah.
I remember before I even got out of residential treatment, I was trying to make lists of things that I wanted to do when I got out. And I remember... I remember finding really new things, but I can't imagine it being fulfilling to me now. So I had to like make myself get into a different frame of mind, if that makes sense. Like, it was kind of like that whole fake it till you make it thing. It was like I had to go, okay, this is going to be great, even though it didn't feel like it was going to be great. Because, you know, we go through that period of apathy where we're still trying to, where it's like we feel empty because we've taken away the thing that was not making us feel okay, but kind of making us feel nothing, taking away those bad feelings. And now, now that we've stopped doing the thing, we're just taking away the bad feelings. we're left having to deal with those feelings and figure out how to, one, cope with them, two, heal from them, and three, find things that are fulfilling to us. And nothing, and initially nothing feels like it's going to be fulfilling. Initially, it feels like, okay, this is all stupid. This is what squares do, you know? I'm like making lists like, okay, I can paint and I can do this. It's going to be so lame. But once I started like buying art supplies and started just like painting a little thing here and there, it was like, okay, you know what? This actually is fun. I do really like this a lot. Oh my God, I can make, you know, and take a picture of something and just practice working on that. And it was like, wow. That does, it's helping. It does help with my anxiety, and this does help with those emotions. So, yeah, a lot of the time it's just kind of like, you kind of have to force yourself to do things even when you don't feel like it.
Yeah, and that's like the hardest part sometimes, because it was like, I remember for me, like, the depressive side of, like, of it was hitting me hard, and I was like, in a lockdown facility, well, it wasn't really a lockdown facility, but sort of, it was like semi, mm-hmm. And I was so depressed, I gained about 50 pounds, I was just nothing but eating, and it was just like, so food filled that void for a while, until it wasn't like enough, and then I was just like, well, this sucks, I feel shitty about myself now, and, you know, it literally went from, okay, one extreme to the other, like from, you know, just stuffing my feelings with food, and before it was, you know, substances, and I found it to be unhealthy, and then it took a while for me to get that healthy relationship back with food again, because it was like, it was easy to do, right? It was like, they fed us 3 times a day, and then I would be like, I'd get DoorDash on the side. So it was like, and yeah, it was about a year that I was in that facility. And it was like, I also felt hopeless, because it was like, you know, it ran the spectrum of people who were conserved. So meaning they had like no opportunity of getting out until their case manager or county said that they could get out of the facility. Whereas I had more faculties about me, and I was like, I don't belong here. You know, like, mm-hmm. That's how I felt. But maybe at the time I did, because I was so whacked out. Like, you know, a lot of stuff gets affected when you're on substances. Like, for me, it was like, it definitely threw my bipolar disorder off. It definitely made me act in ways that I normally wouldn't, which is why I ended up in custody in the first place, and ended up with a legal case because of it. You know, it's like things that I normally would never do, I did, and I was like, and it was only a matter of time, like, thinking back on it, before something crazy was gonna happen, and it did.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I also have on here building and maintaining motivation. That's a huge one. And it's kind of, and that kind of like, it's a natural segue from what we were just talking about. Because I never really had a difficult time building motivation, but it was the maintaining motivation part for me, because it's like, okay, I knew the reasons why I needed to do things, but once I got started, it was continuing to do those things, because, yeah, it's just the whole, once you see an initial result, it's kind of like, okay, but why keep going, you know?
Yeah, like, what's the payoff in this? Why do it? Like, yeah, like, for me, it's been school. Like, I've been doing school for quite a while. And I've had times when I go off and when I come back in. And I know, like, my motivation there is because I want my degree. As long as it doesn't matter, as long as it's taking, like, I'm going to get that degree. That's, like, my motivation. But at times, it's like, why keep doing it? You know, it's like, and that's where it falls off. But it's like, I know that the end goal is going to be, I'm going to have my degree, maybe an opportunity for a better job, and for a career, actually. And then it's like, and then I might not even stop there. I might even go for my master's degree. But that's like iffy because, yeah, school can kind of suck sometimes.
Yeah, but you know, you can't do any of those things if you're relapsing and continuing to use substances.
Right.
And I know for me, and I think I've talked about this in vlogs before, when I first got into recovery, I had no intention of staying in recovery. When I first went into residential, I was thinking, okay, when I get out of here, I'm going to find some kind of way to get high when I get my own place. And it took me an additional 6 months after I got out of residential to find my own place. And I still, when I was signing that lease, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to find some kind of way. But at some point, my mindset kind of shifted. I'm not sure exactly when, but it kind of, I no longer wanted that. I actually, by the time I graduated from outpatient, because I went through residential, intensive outpatient, and then outpatient, I actually was afraid to not be in treatment anymore. I was like, okay, what do I do with my time now? And I started going to like 2 meetings a day and things like that. So I'm not sure if that's a shift, but I think because I had some court dates and I was so close to getting my kids back, and then about not even a month after I finished outpatient, I did get my kids back. And once they were home, there was no there was no thought of getting high then. But and that's where, yeah, the building motivation. I was using worksheets from the Smart Recovery website. I had downloaded a bunch of them and printed them at Opportunity Junction, and they have this thing called a cost-benefit analysis and I cannot remember the name of the other sheet, but basically you write the cost and the benefits of using and the cost and the benefits of staying clean. Because there are, you know, there were obviously benefits to using because we kept using. You know, so I wrote out the cost and the benefits of each, and then I ranked them. And obviously there were more benefits to not using and more costs to using. But I kept that paper in the binder that I took everywhere, so that anytime that I even thought about using, I would look at that paper and I would see what I had to lose.
Yeah.
It was right there in black and white in my own handwriting, you know? And that actually made it so much easier to stay motivated. And, you know, I had these goal setting worksheets. You know, I had, I would come up with new goals every couple months, things that I wanted to do for me and my kids. And that's how I maintained my motivation, because just thinking about it in my head, it's very easy to dismiss things.
Yeah, I hear you. For me, it's like what initially kept me going, like in the beginning or still now, it's like, I know that if I go back, right, I regress. Like everything that I've built up has like, its inherent value, like, because it's taken me this long to get it. Like if I go back, I'm going to destroy whatever I've built up, and it's going to be quick. And it's like, and it always happens like faster than I would expect, you know? And it's always like maybe a little different, but it happens like quickly. Like it's not like before where it took a while to gradually lose things and gradually, like, you know, things were over time, like where I was still working and using and doing whatever else. It's like now it's like, It seems like it's more damaging, just because I'm older, just because I don't recover as quick. I'm not as young as I used to be, and it's like that's story of my life, right? It's just like I started really young, and now it's like it's what 20 something years later, and it's about that time for me. So it's like I'm good. Like, you know, when those intrusive thoughts do come in, like, I know that, like, I have to combat them, because it's, if I give in to those, then I find myself in trouble, because it's like I find myself making a plan and then following through on that, and then I'm in trouble, and I don't want that.
Okay, yeah.
So it's like, so to combat that is like, my plan of action is like, what am I going to do instead of this thought that just came up? What am I going to do instead of that? Like, maybe going to, and still to this day, like, I don't go to meetings as often as I used to in the beginning, but I do still go from time to time. It's just like when I miss people and stuff and want to see how they're doing, and but not get caught up in that drama that can be found in the rooms, you know? It's like, it's there. It can be really messy in there, and it can be really like a popularity contest at times, it seems. But what I do find is like, when sometimes when there's a good speaker, when there's a good message, when there's that fellowship that, you know, because I tend to still like isolate, and it gets me out of that. And I think that, you know, not isolating is one of the key things, especially early in recovery, because once we start to get alone with other thoughts, it's like we can tell ourselves all kinds of stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. How were you able to identify your triggers? Because that's a huge part of stopping a relapse before it comes, is knowing what your triggers are for relapse, your emotional triggers, your physical triggers, your location triggers.
For me, it's more of feelings and stressors. Like when I have those, it's more likely that I want to go pick up. Like, for me, being uncomfortable, being like, you know, arguing with the family, things like that. But specifically, like, there's particular people that trigger me, like my dad, my mom at times, my sisters, you know, when it's like I feel like I'm being hounded, and it's like, to combat that, like, you know, I speak out for myself. I say what I need to say in a calm way instead of arguing back and then just causing the problem to get bigger. But another trigger for me is like either not having money or having too much money. You know what I mean? Like, it's like both extremes are just like, because you feel vulnerable in both. Like, one is because I can do a bunch of stuff. The other is like, I can't do crap. Now I'm stuck. You know, it's like, it's those two extremes.
I never thought of that. I never thought about how you feel vulnerable in both situations. I definitely identify with the having too much money. That was a huge issue for me in the beginning. I still remember the first time I had a lot of money after I got clean. That was when, my mom gave me some money to get a car. And I ended up not being able to get that particular car. So I was still looking around for another car. And while I was looking for another car, I had several hundred dollars just in my purse. And I remember when I had that realization that, oh my God, I would not have been able to hang on to this, you know, earlier this year. No, she wouldn't even have trusted me with this amount of money earlier this year. This was in like November of 2018, and I went into treatment in early March of 2018. And I had that brief fleeting thought, and then I was like, no, I need a car, because I had been riding the bus that whole time. I need a car. But it was an issue, probably a lot that first year. Every time I had had more than a couple hundred dollars, It was a thought in my head, and it was like, no, I can't do this. It was always, I needed that money for something else. And my kids didn't trust me that first year. And it was all about regaining their trust, back over here. You know, I just, yeah. Oh gosh, things were. Talk about regaining trust. Oh, my oldest daughter, she was trying to get sent back to foster care the first 6 months. She did not want to be with me. She didn't trust me. She didn't like anything I said. It was like, oh, you want to be a parent now? Okay. No. So, yeah, I had a lot of work. I was super resentful. And I understood. I totally got it. And I tried to be super patient. But so, yeah, every time one of those thoughts popped up in my head, it was like, no, I have to do what's right for my kids. Because I had already let them down so much. And it had taken me a long time to be able to realize just how much.
Yeah.
Now, what about changing your people, places, and things?
That's easy. I isolate, so. And I don't go out as much. And then, like, I don't hang out with people that obviously are active. And then the things that I used to do, I don't do anymore. Like, just ratchet stuff, you know? It's like, because it comes with that life. It comes with, like, oh, the ways of finding and using more, whatever. Like, mm-hmm. it's like a full-time job. Like, you're always on the lookout for something more. And then it's like, it's draining. So now that I don't have to do that, like, I'm at peace.
Yeah, I think in the beginning that was difficult for me. Not so much because I was running the streets, because I hardly left my house. People came to me, but it was because I had a relationship that I hadn't wanted to let go of. And because I had a friend who, and he was like my best friend, and he was one of the few people who I knew who also maintained a kind of normal life. And his birthday's the day before mine. So every year, we would celebrate his birthday going into my birthday. And so it felt so weird not being able to do that. So that first year, he came over on his birthday, and he brought me like a birthday gift and stuff, and we sat outside and talked. But it was just like, okay, but we're totally sober. Oh my God, what is going on? So I had that realization that we can't do our birthday ritual anymore. And it was sad, but you know, I was kind of like, okay, that chapter of my life is ending.
Yeah.
And then the changing your places thing, though, that didn't really work for me. Because I ended up getting a place, getting a house, two blocks from where I was living before. It was the only house that I could find. And I was trying to avoid applying for any places in that neighborhood, but nowhere else was accepting me with my credit. And finally, I applied for that place, and my family was like, okay, I'll accept you right here and now. Just get me the deposit. And I was like, well, dang.
And, the haunted house, right?
It was the one that had... No, the haunted one was the one that I had lived in before I got clean.
Okay.
It was the one that had gotten burned down and rebuilt.
Okay.
But, yeah, so I mentioned it to my counselor in outpatient, and she said, well, sometimes you have to get well or you're sick.
Yeah.
And I was like, but I don't want to. And one of the things I had to keep telling myself was, you know, you live in a house, you don't live in the neighborhood, you live inside the house. And I don't spend time with my neighbors or anything, you know, fine. It wasn't, you know, living in that neighborhood wasn't really a trigger for me. Gradually, you know, little things that used to trigger me have come to not trigger me anymore. Pretty much the only thing that triggers me is because I was a meth addict. Pretty much the only thing that triggers me now is this if I smell it. Because every now and then I'll be driving somewhere and I'll smell it in the air. But it also smells so disgusting to me, it doesn't make me want to use it. Whereas in early recovery, being tired, having too much to do, feeling overwhelmed, things like that would trigger me. Because it was like, like I said, in the back of my mind, I would know, I would have this thought, okay, I know we could take care of that. And I would have to rationalize with that, like, no, that actually doesn't take care of it. You'll just end up working on the same thing over and over again for 5 hours. You won't get anything done, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes you have to like rationalize, you have to, you know, use logic against these thoughts. Because right. your brain will play tricks on you.
Definitely.
So, what are your thoughts on recovery versus recovered?
I'm never going to be recovered totally. But you know what I mean? Like, because I would hear that in meetings. I'm a recovered this, I'm a recovered that. I was like, yeah, for me, it doesn't work that way because it's an ongoing process. You know, because there's always going to be that little switch in my brain that, you know, that can very easily go back if I don't combat it, because it's like it's there, it's like that gateway's been open, you know, it's like I don't know when it happened, but it did, and I became addicted to something. Now it's like I'll never be able to use it normally. I'll never be able to say that I can casually consume something that I use for years, like almost on a daily basis, and like pretend like it'll be normal. I can't. I know that. So that's why for me, like the whole recovery thing doesn't work.
Okay. Yeah, I always felt kind of weird about that too. And I know where it comes from. It comes from AA literature. In the big book, the word recovered, it's used a lot, especially in the first chapter. Like basically they're saying they hope teachers, you know, becoming recovered.
Yeah.
But I always felt weird about saying, you know, I'm recovered. You know, even after 5 years, you know, it kind of, I can't bring myself to say, you know, I'm a recovered meth addict. It just feels weird because, you know, I don't know what any given tragedy could drive me to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to get too cocky, you know? I don't want to tempt fate. So, you know, if someone else wants to say they're recovered, that's their personal feelings about their situation. But for me, it just feels like I can't bring myself to say it.
I hear you.
I think I went through my notes out of order. So I'm like looking through to make sure that I mentioned everything I wanted to mention. Oh yeah, this has been a great conversation. I am loving this.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we've gone through all of my notes. Do you have anything else to add?
I just, you know, for me, it's just continuing that fire, right, that I have right now for my recovery, for life itself. Like, I have a lot of things good that are upcoming if I just continue to stay this path. Like, my family bought a house in Cancun. Like, right now, unfortunately, I can't travel outside of the country because I'm bound. But after that, like, vacations in Cancun, come on now. Like, stuff like that, you know what I mean? It's like, and there's going to be, like, a lot of family events that I want to be present for and, like, not excluded from. And it's just a matter of staying on this path.
Okay, yeah, totally understandable. I just can't imagine going back. Just the idea of it, and I mean, it's the person I was 5.5 years ago, I don't even recognize that person, and to be here again. or any version of her. So I wouldn't want to let down the people who I love like that. I wouldn't want to let down my father's memory like that. You know, he was so proud of me before he passed. I can't imagine, you know, or letting down my mom. I try to remember the ways that I let them down when I was in my addiction. There was one day I was supposed to pick my mom up from work, and the guy I was talking to then at the time, he had my car, and I fell asleep, and I woke up over an hour after she was supposed to get off work, and he hadn't come back with my car, and she had walked home in the rain. And I don't ever want to be the person who's the reason my mom is walking home in the rain when I have a vehicle, because I wasn't present enough to make sure that she got home safely. Anything could have happened to her, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, if we have nothing else to add, I'm proud of you too. So if we have nothing else to add, that is the end of our show. If you have not followed us on social media, we are at Awkwardish Podcast on Instagram and on Threads. And keep an ear open for our next episode. Have a great day, everyone.
All right. Bye-bye.